May it please the court. The trial court erred when it denied Burnside's motion to suppress because the police merely had suspicion that Burnside was involved in criminal activity. And the trial court committed plain error when it participated in plea negotiations. The motion to suppress is addressed in our briefs in detail. I'll briefly address it and then turn to the guilty plea issue. The police's observations of Brian Burnside merely provided them with suspicion that he was involved in criminal activity. Importantly, two officers observed Burnside interact with Diaba Hallam. Sergeant Bainter testified expressly at the suppression hearing that by the time he viewed the interaction, Ms. Hallam had already approached the vehicle and was leaning inside. He did not see her approach, and therefore the trial court's finding that he could deduce that Ms. Hallam obtained a plastic bag from Burnside is clearly erroneous. His express testimony contradicts that finding. The second officer who observed Burnside and Hallam is Miller. Officer Miller's proximity and his failure to see the fact that Hallam approached the vehicle with two cartons of cigarettes demonstrates it was implausible for him to infer that Ms. Hallam obtained either the plastic bag or any drugs from Burnside. He was parked across a four-lane street, approximately several hundred feet away, and he could not see the fact, although he said Ms. Hallam approached empty-handed, he could not see the two cartons of cigarettes. Therefore, it's implausible that he could infer that she obtained either the sack or the drugs from Burnside. With respect to the guilty plea, the trial court committed plain error by its comments at the change of plea hearing. There are two important considerations here with respect to the guilty plea. One, there was no written plea agreement. Two, Burnside was facing a mandatory life sentence, whether he pled guilty or went to trial.
But can I get back to this didn't see anything? At least according to the statement of facts in the government's brief, that as Hallam walked away from the truck, Banner and Officer Miller saw a brown plastic grocery bag in her hand, which she had not been holding when she approached the truck.
That's what the government said in its brief, Your Honor. The record shows, as to Boehner, the record clearly shows, he testified at the suppression hearing, he did not see Hallam approach the vehicle. So he could not deduce that she walked away with a bag she didn't have before, because by the time he arrived on the scene, she was already leaning into the vehicle. Now, the trial court didn't make any findings as to what Mr. Miller observed. It merely addressed Sergeant Boehner when it found that an officer watched Hallam approach empty-handed and walk away with a bag. There's no mention of Mr. Miller's observations in the trial court's findings. What the record shows is he did testify at the suppression hearing that he saw her approach without anything in her hand. But there's no dispute in the record that Ms. Hallam had two cartons of cigarettes when she approached the vehicle and that she gave them to Burnside. Therefore, based on his physical proximity to the scene, it's simply implausible for him to infer that Ms. Hallam obtained anything from Burnside. And one cannot connect what was found on her or in the dumpster with Burnside if one is unable to see with any clarity what she had when she approached.
Well, notwithstanding that, I mean, there was evidence that, that she approached empty-handed, given the fact that you talked about these cartons of cigarettes. But there is, at least that's in the record.
It's in the record. It wasn't. The trial court didn't make any finding on that. So to the extent a finding needs to be made, we would suggest that the suppression ruling should either be vacated or remanded for a finding on that particular issue. As to the guilty plea, the trial court violated Rule 11. As I mentioned, there was no written plea agreement, and Mr. Burnside was facing life in prison. The record demonstrates that he stated he was not thinking straight and needed a day or two to think about whether he was going to plead guilty. And then Mr. Burnside, after the government acknowledged that he was struggling with the issues, expressly stated he wanted to go to trial. At that point, the plea colloquy should have ended. But what took place after that was an exchange between the court and Mr. Burnside's...
Why should it have ended there? You may not be aware of this, but we have cases where district judges did end the plea colloquy there. The defendant is convicted at trial, and we have reversed on the ground that the district judge should not have summarily rejected the effort to plead guilty, which had been stated earlier, but should have engaged in an extended colloquy with the defendant to figure out what his real wishes were. Well, here, that's exactly what the district judge did. And now you say, and, of course, that violates the Rule 11 by engaging in plea negotiations. But it, you know, another perspective is it's what district judges have been told they should do when the defendant comes to court and says, on the same day, both I want to plead guilty and I don't want to plead guilty.
Well, Your Honor, I think the circumstances here demonstrate that Burnside was not thinking in a knowing and voluntary manner, and the court should have stopped. But in addition to that, the court didn't merely explore by asking questions similar to what's in the list on Rule 11 as to voluntariness and what he intended. The court said two things. First, it commented about purported benefits of pleading guilty early on in the colloquy. There are absolutely no benefits to pleading guilty for Mr. Burnside. So it left the impression, whether it was intended to educate or not, that there was some advantage to Mr. Burnside pleading guilty. Then, after Burnside expressed his desire to go to trial, the trial court engaged in an exchange with Burnside's counsel. It was clear, based on the record, that counsel was trying to convince Burnside to plead guilty. And under Casales, regardless of the trial court's intent, it shouldn't have engaged in a dialogue that had the effect of bolstering what the defense counsel was trying to convince his client to do. That role is for the defense counsel. It should not take place with any judicial participation, whether the intent is to educate or not. And that, given the earlier statement that Burnside was not thinking straight and his express statement that he wanted to go to trial, pushes the judge into the realm of judicial participation and amounts to clear error. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Ms. Mullen.
May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the government. Judge Kaney, I'd actually like to start with a question that you asked about the observations of the officers. I think it's important to note that we have two officers observing this. They are in separate squad cars at different vantage points. Officer Miller is the officer who saw Hallam actually approach the truck. Officer Bancher testified that when he pulled into the area at that point, Ms. Hallam was already leaning into the truck. So when the district court found that, and Officer Miller, I should back up, also said that when she approached the truck, she was empty-handed. So I think when the district court made that finding, the court was speaking to what Officer Miller saw, but also responding to the lengthy argument that defense counsel had made at the motion to suppress, that this testimony couldn't be credited because Officer Bancher didn't see everything. And the judge drops a footnote in his order that says there was, you know, extensive argument about this, but the fact of the matter is we have testimony that she approached that car empty-handed, and we have testimony from two officers that when she left the car, she had this plastic grocery bag in her hands. So I think that that's what the district court was talking about. I also think it's important to note that we're not to look at these probable cause facts or the facts that support probable cause in a vacuum, that the officers here had already received two tips from two different people within a month apart that suggested that Mr. Burnside was a high-level cocaine dealer in Peoria, that he was receiving between a half kilogram and kilogram of cocaine every month, that he himself engaged in the deliveries and did so from a number of different vehicles. So the officers had that information as well as the criminal background check on Mr. Burnside that revealed that he had at least five prior felony convictions for manufacture and delivery of a controlled substance. So when the officers are viewing this encounter between Mr. Burnside and Ms. Hallam, they had that backdrop as well. And again, after Ms. Hallam walks away from the car, they keep her under surveillance, immediately walk up to her within 15 to 20 seconds of her leaving the car. She's got the rock of crack cocaine in her hand. They watched before they approached as she disposed of the plastic bag in the dumpster. They immediately retrieved the plastic bag. It has the empty kilogram wrapper that, according to the officers, had a very strong odor of cocaine. They have the plastic baggies in there with the white residue and drug paraphernalia. And Mr. Burnside, of course, is being kept under constant surveillance, and that's the point at which they stopped him and arrested him based upon the probable cause for possession of controlled substances. if the court has no question about the probable cause findings or the search warrant, I'll move on to the plea colloquy. I think it's really important here to look at the entire plea transcript, because we're confident that when this court does that, it will become abundantly clear that Judge McDade was very responsive to Mr. Burnside throughout the plea hearing. Directly before the interchange between the judge and Bruce Cowan, who was at the time representing the defendant said, "I want to go to trial." That's true. And that came on the heels of an extended discussion between the defendant and the court about the sentence he was facing, that it was a mandatory life sentence if he pled guilty. The judge explained to the defendant, "The only discretion I would ever have to sentence below a mandatory minimum sentence is if the government files a motion under 3553E. The court then repeatedly told Mr. Burnside, "I have absolutely no authority to compel such a motion. That is completely up to the government." Mr. Burnside at one point said, as counsel pointed out, I feel like I'm not thinking straight. I feel like I need a break." And they'd already taken one break so he could talk to his family. The court immediately said, "That's fine. We'll recess overnight," and turned to counsel and his clerk to try to figure out when they might be able to reschedule it for the next day. It was at that point that the AUSA, Mr. Murphy, stood up and said, "I just want to make this abundantly clear, because there has been this discussion about the potential for a motion, of 3553E motion. The government is not going to file that motion. We have given Mr. Burnside ample opportunity repeatedly to cooperate with us. He has not been interested in doing that. I just want to make clear on the record, we are not filing the motion. The defendant faces a mandatory sentence whether he pleads guilty or goes to trial." So that was the backdrop before the judge said anything at all to the defendant. At that point, it was the defendant's counsel that said, when the defendant said, "I want to go to trial," then defendant's counsel said, "You really don't want to do that. You're confused about what's going to happen at that trial. You think you're going to get to relitigate the motion to suppress, and you aren't." The counsel then turns to the judge and says the same thing: "My client's confused about procedurally what can happen now with respect to that motion." And that's his client's primary concern. The judge responds, "No, that issue is dead. That issue cannot be litigated to the jury. Procedurally, what will happen at a trial is the government will present its evidence." So that was the extent of the discussion between the defendant and the judge. The judge was clearly just trying to make sure that Mr. Cowan understood what was going to happen. Again, in this situation, it's going to be a mandatory life sentence whether he pled guilty or whether he went to trial.
It can't be construed where the district judge, Judge McDade, was advocating a particular position that the defendant should take?
I think absolutely not, Judge Kenney. I think when you look at this, it's clear that every time the defendant wants to take a break, the judge says that's fine. Even at the end, when the defendant switches again and says, "I want to plead guilty," Judge McDade said, "Are you sure? Do you want to think about this? And we'll, do you want to do this today, or do you need time to think about it?" And the defendant said, "No, I'm ready to do it." And the judge said, "I've been very patient with you over the last 30 minutes. You just need to decide what you want to do." I don't think there's anything. I think it's clear from the transcript Judge McDade really wasn't invested one way or the other about what Mr. Burnside wanted to do. He understood that this was a weighty decision. This was a life sentence. And he understood certainly at the plea colloquy that I think for the first time the judge understood that the government was not going to be filing a motion, and that that wasn't an option for Mr. Burnside in terms of his cooperation. So I think when we look at the entire plea colloquy, it's clear that the judge was being responsive to Mr. Burnside and certainly understanding that he was facing a difficult decision and might need some time to take that decision. If the court has no questions, I'll return the balance of my time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Anything further, Mr. Hurley?
Just a couple of brief points. While there was testimony about what Mr. Miller or Officer Miller did or didn't see, there weren't any findings by the district judge on that issue. So we're left to speculate as to whether the trial court found his testimony credible. The only factual finding on what was observed between Burnside and Hallam and whether she approached the vehicle empty-handed or not was related to Sergeant Bainter, and the record unequivocally shows that Sergeant Bainter didn't see Ms. Hallam approach the vehicle. As to the guilty plea exchange, it doesn't matter whether the trial court intended to simply educate It doesn't matter whether the record shows that he was trying to advocate that Mr. Burnside plead guilty. Rule 11 prohibits trial judges from involving themselves in negotiations, and it shouldn't have mentioned any.
What language concretely are you relying on in Rule 11? The second sentence of Rule 11C1?
Yes, Your Honor.
The one that says a judge cannot engage in negotiations about plea agreements. But there was no plea agreement. There was no plea agreement being negotiated. There was no plea agreement that was ever made.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we cited that.
Rule 11C is about negotiating plea agreements. And since none was ever negotiated, I don't see how the judge could possibly have violated it.
We cited the D.C. Circuit Court. It expressly rejected that notion, and Casales is also instructed there. Whether there's a bargaining between the government or defense counsel doesn't matter. The court is prohibited from weighing in such a way that it could have an inherently coercive effect.
Well, that's
on the
why
defendant.
I asked the question I did. I don't think Judge McDade wasn't advocating either plead guilty or not.
Again, advocation doesn't matter. The trial court talked about
I'm now completely lost. You can't be serious in saying the court can't weigh in. All of Rule 11A tells the judge he's got to give the defendant advice, make sure the defendant knows something. There's a big thumb on the scale against pleading guilty. Judge has to make sure he's knowledgeable and so on. That's what Rule 11 is all about. 11C says you can't engage in negotiations about the agreement, but with respect to whether the defendant is pleading guilty or going to trial, the judge is entitled to give advice and indeed is required to give advice. So what's the problem in giving the advice, Mr. Burnside, you have to understand that if you go to trial, you won't be able to relitigate the motion to suppress? Just sounds like an addition to the Rule 11A list.
Well, Your Honor, the judge said more than just that. He talked about benefits and purported advantages of pleading guilty. And he didn't simply talk about procedural issues. He mentioned the type of evidence the government would submit at trial. And we respectfully
submit. That's also on the Rule 11A list. Judge has to establish a factual basis for the plea. He goes over with the defendant in detail what the evidence would be if the case went to trial. It's part of the drill, but now you seem to be saying just going through the drill is the problem.
Your Honor, we would respectfully submit you have to take into account the entire circumstances here, the uncertainty and the express statement to go to trial, and that the court crossed the bound into judicial participation. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And, Mr. Hurley, we appreciate your willingness and that of your law firm to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as to your client. The case is taken under advisement.